"You're a very fat, ugly little girl," a voice said insistently in her ear. Hot, fetid breath. She shuddered and tried to smile at the horribly beautiful woman walking toward them. Thea. I assume you've heard by now that Bonnie is married to Madeline's ex-husband, Nathan. So that was complicated. You might want to explore that. I'm not telling you how to do your job, of course. Bonnie. That had absolutely nothing to do with anything. Our relationship was completely amicable. Just this morning, I left a vegetarian lasagna on their doorstep for her poor husband. Gabrielle. I was new at the school. I didn't know a soul. "Oh, we're such a caring school," the principal told me. Blah, blah, blah. Let me tell you, the first thing I thought when I walked into that playground on that kindergarten orientation day was clicky. Clicky, clicky, clicky. I'm not surprised someone ended up dead. Oh, all right, I guess that's overstating it. I was a little surprised. Chapter 5. Celeste pushed open the glass door of Blue Blues and saw Madeline straight away. She was sharing a table with a small, thin young girl wearing a blue denim skirt and a plain white V-necked T-shirt. Celeste didn't recognize the girl. She felt an instant, sharp sense of disappointment. "Just the two of us," Madeline had said. Celeste readjusted her expectations of the morning. She took a deep breath. Recently, she'd noticed something strange happening when she talked to people in groups. She couldn't quite remember how to be. She'd find herself thinking, "Did I just laugh too loudly? Or did I forget to laugh? Did I just repeat myself?" For some reason, when it was just her and Madeline, it was okay. It was because she'd known Madeline for such a long time. Her personality felt intact when it was just the two of them. Maybe she needed a tonic. That's what her grandmother would have said. Well, what was a tonic? She weaved through the tables toward them. They hadn't noticed her yet. They were deep in conversation. She could see the girl's profile clearly. She was too young to be a school mother. She must be a nanny or an au pair. Probably an au pair. Maybe European, with not much English. That would explain the slightly stiff, strained way she was sitting, as though she needed to concentrate. Of course, maybe she had nothing to do with the school at all. Madeline travelled with ease through dozens of overlapping social circles, making both lifelong friends and lifetime enemies along the way. Probably more of the latter. Madeline thrived on conflict and was never happier than when she was outraged. Madeline saw Celeste and her face lit up. One of the nicest things about Madeline was the way her face transformed when she saw you, as if there were no one else in the world she'd rather see. "Hello, birthday girl," Celeste called out. Madeline's companion swung around in her chair. She had brown hair scraped back painfully hard from the forehead, like she was in the military or the police force. "What happened to you, Madeline?" said Celeste, as she got close enough to see Madeline's leg propped up on the chair. She smiled politely at the girl, and the girl seemed to flinch, as if Celeste had sneered, not smiled. Oh God, she had smiled at her, hadn't she? "This is Jane," said Madeline. "She saved me from the side of the road after I twisted my ankle trying to save young lives. Jane, this is Celeste." "Hi," said Jane. There was something naked and raw about Jane's face, like it had just been scrubbed too hard. She was chewing gum, with tiny movements of her jaw, as if it were a secret. "Jane is a new kindergarten mother," said Madeline, as Celeste sat down, "like you. So it's my responsibility to bring you both up to date with everything you need to know about school politics at Piriwee Public. It's a minefield, girls. A minefield, I tell you." "School politics?" Jane frowned and used two hands to pull hard on her ponytail, so it was even tighter still. "I won't get involved in any school politics."
"Me either," agreed Celeste.
Jane would always remember how she recklessly tempted fate that day. "I won't get involved in school politics," she'd said. And someone up there had overheard and hadn't liked her attitude. Far too confident. "We'll see about that," they'd said, and then sat back and had a good old laugh at her expense. Celeste's birthday gift was a set of Waterford crystal champagne glasses.
"Oh, my God, I love them. They're absolutely gorgeous," said Madeline.
She carefully took one out of the box and held it up to the light, admiring the intricate design, rows of tiny moons.
"They must have cost you a small fortune."
She almost said, "Thank God you're so rich, darling." But she stopped herself in time. She would have said it if it were just the two of them, but presumably Jane, a young single mother, was not well off, and of course it was impolite to talk about money in company. She did actually know that. She said this defensively to her husband in her head, because he was the one who was always reminding her of the social norms she insisted on flouting. Why do they all have to tread so very delicately around Celeste's money? It was like wealth was an embarrassing medical condition. It was the same with Celeste's beauty. Strangers gave Celeste the same furtive looks they gave to people with missing limbs. And if Madeline ever mentioned Celeste's looks, Celeste responded with something like shame. "Shh," she'd say, looking around fearfully in case someone overheard. Everyone wanted to be rich and beautiful, but the truly rich and beautiful had to pretend as if they were just the same as everyone else. Ugh, it was a funny old world.
"So, school politics, girls," she said as she carefully replaced the glass in the box. "We'll start at the top with the blonde bobs."
"The blonde bobs?" Celeste squinted, as if there were going to be a test afterward.
"The blonde bobs rule the school. If you want to be on the PTA, you have to have a blonde bob," said Madeline. She demonstrated the required haircut with her hand. "It's like a bylaw."
Jane chortled, a dry little chuckle, and Madeline found herself desperate to make her laugh again.
"It shouldn't be peroxide blonde, obviously. It should be expensive blonde. And then you get it cut in that sort of mum haircut where it's like a helmet."
"You're being mean."
Celeste tapped her lightly on the arm. "I'm not," protested Madeline. "I love that hairstyle. I told Lucy Ponder when I'm ready to run for the PTA, she can give me the approved blonde bob." She said to Jane, "Lucy Ponder is a local hairdresser, and she's the daughter of the lady who lives in the house overlooking the school playground. Everyone is connected to everyone in Piriwee."
"Really?" said Jane. A flash of something both hopeful and fearful crossed her face, and she glanced quickly over her shoulder.
"It's okay, we're safe, no blonde bobs in sight," said Madeline.
"So are the blonde bobs nice?" asked Celeste. "Or should we steer clear?"
"Well, they mean well," said Madeline. "They mean very, very well. They're like, what are they like?
She tapped her fingers on the table, trying to think of the right way to describe the blonde bobs. They're like mum prefects. They feel very strongly about their roles as school mums. It's like their religion. They're fundamentalist mothers.
You're exaggerating, said Celeste.
Of course I am, agreed Madeline.
Are any of the kindergarten mothers blonde bobs? Asked Jane.
Let's see now, said Madeline. Oh, yes, Harper. She's your quintessential blonde bob. She's on the PTA and she has a horrendously gifted daughter with a mild nut allergy. So she's part of the zeitgeist, lucky girl.
Come on now, Madeline. There's nothing lucky about having a child with a nut allergy, said Celeste.
I know, said Madeline. She knew she was getting too show-offy in her desire to make Jane laugh. I'm teasing. Let's see. Who else? Oh, there's Carol Quigley. She's sort of a wannabe blonde bob. She's not quite blonde enough. She's not actually on the PTA yet, but she's doing her bit for the school by keeping it clean. She's obsessed with cleanliness. She runs in and out of the classroom with a bottle of spray and wipe.
She does not, said Celeste.
She does!
What about the dads?
Jane opened a packet of chewing gum and slipped another piece into her mouth, like illegal contraband. She appeared to be obsessed with gum, although you couldn't really see her chewing it. She didn't quite meet Madeline's eye as she asked the question. Was she hoping to meet a single dad, perhaps?
Well, I've heard on the grapevine we've got at least one stay-at-home dad in kindergarten this year, said Madeline. His wife is some hotshot in the corporate world. Jackie somebody. She's the CEO of a bank, I think.
Not Jackie Montgomery, said Celeste.
That's it.
Goodness, murmured Celeste.
We'll probably never see her. It's hard for the mums working full-time.
Who else works full-time?
Oh, Renata. Renata is in one of those finance jobs. Equities or, I don't know, stock options? Is that a thing? Or maybe she's an analyst. I think that's it. She analyzes stuff. Every time I ask her to explain her job, I forget to listen. Her children are geniuses too, obviously.
So Renata is a blonde bop, said Jane.
No, no, she's a career woman. She has a full-time nanny. I think she just imported a new one from France. She likes European stuff. Renata doesn't have time to help at the school. She has board meetings to attend. Whenever you talk to her, she's just been to a board meeting, or she's on her way back from a board meeting, or she's preparing for a board meeting. I mean, how often do these boards have to meet?
Well, it depends on, began Celeste.
It was a rhetorical question, interrupted Madeline. My point is, she can't go more than 5 minutes before she mentions a board meeting. Just like Thea Cunningham can't go more than 5 minutes without mentioning she has 4 children. She's a kindergarten mother too, by the way. She has 4 children. She can't get over it.
Do I sound bitchy?
Yes, said Celeste.
Sorry, said Madeline. She did feel a bit guilty.
I was trying to be entertaining. Blame my ankle. Quite seriously, it's a very lovely school and everyone is very lovely and we're all going to have a lovely, lovely time and make lovely, lovely new friends.
Jane chortled and did her discreet gum-chewing thing. She seemed to be drinking coffee and chewing gum at the same time. It was peculiar.
So these gifted and talented children, asked Jane, are the children tested or something?
There's a whole identification process, said Madeline, and they get special programs and opportunities. They stay in the same class,
but they're given more difficult assignments, I guess. And sometimes they're pulled out for separate sessions with a specialist teacher. Look, obviously, you don't want your child being bored in class, waiting for everyone else to catch up. I do understand that. I just get a little... Well, for example, last year, I had a little conflict with Renata.
Madeline loves conflict, said Celeste to Jane.
Renata somehow found time in between board meetings to ask the teachers to organise an exclusive little excursion just for the gifted kids. It was to see a play. Well, come on now, you don't have to be bloody gifted to enjoy theatre. I'm the marketing manager at the Pirrawee Peninsula Theatre, you see, so that's how I got wind of it.
She won, of course, grinned Celeste.
Of course I won, said Madeline. I got a special group discount, and all the kids went, and I got half-price champagne at interval for all the parents, and we had a great time.
Oh, speaking of which, said Celeste, I nearly forgot to give you your champagne. Did I? Oh, yes. Here it is.
She rummaged through her voluminous straw basket in her typically breathless way and handed over a bottle of Bollinger.
I can't give you champagne glasses without champagne.
Let's have some now! Madeline lifted the bottle by the neck, suddenly inspired.
No, no, said Celeste. Are you crazy? It's too early for drinking. We have to pick the kids up in 2 hours, and it's not chilled.
Champagne breakfast, said Madeline. It's all in the way you package it. We'll have champagne and orange juice, half a glass each, over 2 hours. Jane, are you in?
I guess I could have a sip, said Jane. I'm a cheap drunk.
I bet you are, because you weigh about 10 kilos, said Madeline. We'll get on well. I love cheap drunks. More for me.
Madeline, said Celeste, keep it for another time.
But it's the festival of Madeline, said Madeline sadly, and I'm injured.
Celeste rolled her eyes. Pass me a glass.
Thea. Jane was tipsy when she picked up Ziggy from orientation. So, you know, it just paints a certain type of picture, doesn't it? Young single mother drinking first thing in the morning. Chewing gum, too. Not a good first impression. That's all I'm saying.
Bonnie. For heaven's sake, nobody was drunk. They had a champagne breakfast at Blue Blue, Sir Madeline's 40th. They were just a little giggly.
Well, that's what I heard, anyway. We actually couldn't make orientation day because we were doing a family healing retreat in Byron Bay. It was an incredible spiritual experience. Would you like the website address?
Harper.
You knew from the very first day that Madeline, Celeste, and Jane were a little threesome. They arrived with their arms around one another like 12-year-olds. Renata and I didn't get invited to their little soiree, even though we'd known Madeline since all our boys were in kindergarten together. But as I said to Renata that night, when we were having the most divine degustation menu at Remy's, and that was before the rest of Sydney discovered it, by the way, I really didn't care less.
Samantha. I was working. Stu took Lily to orientation. He mentioned some of the mothers had just come from a champagne breakfast. I said, right. What are their names? They sound like my sort of people.
Jonathan. I missed all that. Stu and I were talking about cricket.
Melissa. You didn't hear this from me, but apparently Madeline McKenzie got so drunk that morning, she fell over and sprained her ankle.
Graham. I think you're barking up the wrong tree there. I don't see how an ill-advised champagne breakfast could have led to murder and mayhem. Do you?
Champagne
is never a mistake. That had always been Madeline's mantra. But afterwards, Madeline did wonder if just this once it might have been a tiny error of judgment. Not because they were drunk. They weren't. It was because when the three of them walked into the school, laughing together, Madeline had decided she didn't want to stay in the car and miss seeing Chloe come out, so she hopped in, hanging onto their elbows. They trailed behind them the unmistakable scent of party. People never like missing out on a party. Chapter 6. Jane was not drunk when she arrived back at the school to pick up Ziggy. She had had 3 mouthfuls of that champagne at the most. But she was feeling euphoric. There had been something about the pop of the champagne cork, the naughtiness of it, the unexpectedness of the whole morning, those beautiful, long, fragile glasses catching the sunlight, the surfy-looking barista bringing over 3 exquisite little cupcakes with candles, the smell of the ocean, the feeling that she was maybe making new friends with these women who were somehow so different from any of her other friends, older, wealthier, more sophisticated. "You'll make new friends when Ziggy starts school," her mother had kept telling her, excitedly and irritatingly, and Jane had to make a big effort not to roll her eyes and behave like a sulky, nervous teenager starting at a new high school. Jane's mother had 3 best friends whom she had met 25 years ago when Jane's older brother, Dane, started kindergarten. They all went out for coffee on that first morning and had been inseparable ever since. "I don't need new friends," Jane had told her mother. "Yes, you do. You need to be friends with other mothers," her mother said. "You support one another. You understand what you're going through." But Jane had tried that with mother's group and failed. She just couldn't relate to those bright, chatty women and their bubbly conversations about husbands who weren't stepping up, and renovations that weren't finished before the baby was born, and that hilarious time they were so busy and tired they left the house without putting on any makeup. Jane, who was wearing no makeup at the time and never wore makeup, had kept her face blank and benign while inwardly shouting, "What the fuck?" And yet, strangely, she related to Madeline and Celeste, even though they really had nothing in common except for the fact that their children were starting kindergarten, and even though Jane was pretty sure that Madeline would never leave the house without makeup either, but she felt already that she and Celeste, who didn't wear makeup either, luckily her beauty was shocking enough without improvement, could tease Madeline about this, and she'd laugh and tease them back, as if they were already established friends. So Jane wasn't ready for what happened. She wasn't on alert. She was too busy getting to know Pirouette public. Everything so cute and compact. It made life seem so manageable. Enjoying the sunshine and the still novel smell of the sea. Jane felt filled with pleasure at the thought of Ziggy's school days. For the first time since he was born, the responsibility of being in charge of Ziggy's childhood weighed lightly on her. Her new apartment was walking distance from the school. They would walk to school each day, past the beach and up the tree-lined hill. At her own suburban primary school, she'd had views of a 6-lane highway and the scent of barbecued chicken from the shop next door. There had been no cleverly designed, shady little play areas with charming, colourful tile mosaics of grinning dolphins and whales. There were certainly no murals of underwater sea scenes or stone sculptures of tortoises in the middle of sandpits. "This school is so cute," she said to Madeline as she and Celeste helped Madeline hop along to a seat. It's magical.
I know. Last year's school trivia night raised money to redo the schoolyard, said Madeline. The blonde Bobs know how to fundraise. The theme was dead celebrities. It was great fun. Hey, are you any good at trivia, Jane?
I'm excellent at trivia, said Jane. Trivia and jigsaws are my two areas of expertise.
Jigsaws, said Madeline. I'd rather stick pins in my eyes. Ow!
She sat down on a blue-painted wooden bench built around the tree trunk of a Moreton Bay fig and put her ankle up. A crowd of other parents soon formed around them, and Madeline held court, introducing Jane and Celeste to the mothers with older children she already knew, and telling everyone the story of how she twisted her ankle, saving young lives.
Typical Madeline, a woman called Carol said to Jane. She was a soft-looking woman, wearing a puffy-sleeved floral sundress and a big straw sun hat. She looked like she was off to a white clapboard church in Little House on the Prairie.
Carol, wasn't she the one Madeline said liked to clean? Clean Carol.
Madeline just loves a fight, said Carol. She'll take on anyone. Our sons play soccer together, and last year she got in an argument with this giant dad. All the husbands were hiding, and Madeline was standing this close to him, poking her finger into his chest like this, not giving an inch. It's a wonder she didn't get herself killed.
Oh, him? The under-7 age coordinator?
Madeline spat the words, under-7 age coordinator, as if they were serial killer.
I shall loathe that man until the day I die.
Meanwhile, Celeste stood off slightly to the side, chatting in that ruffled, hesitant way of hers, which Jane was already beginning to recognize as characteristic of Celeste.
What did you say your son's name was again?
Carol asked Jane.
Ziggy, said Jane.
Ziggy, repeated Carol uncertainly. Is that an ethnic sort of a name?
Hello there, I'm Renata.
A woman with a crisp, grey, symmetrical haircut and intense brown eyes behind stylish black-framed spectacles appeared in front of Jane, hand outstretched. It was like being accosted by a politician. She said her name with strange emphasis, as if Jane had been expecting her.
Hello? I'm Jane. How are you?
Jane tried to match her enthusiasm. She wondered if this was the school principal. A well-dressed blonde woman, who Jane thought probably qualified as one of Madeline's blonde bobs, bustled over with a yellow envelope in her hand.
Renata, she said, ignoring Jane, I've got that education report we were talking about at dinner.
Just give me a moment, Harper,
said Renata with a touch of impatience. She smiled at Jane.
Jane, nice to meet you. I'm Amabella's mum, and I have Jackson in year two. That's Amabella, by the way, not Annabella. It's French. We didn't make it up.
Harper continued to hover at Renata's shoulder, nodding along respectfully as Renata spoke, like those people who stand behind politicians at press conferences.
Well, I just wanted to introduce you to Amabella and Jackson's nanny, who also happens to be French. Quelle coïncidence! This is Juliette.
Renata indicated a petite girl with short red hair and an oddly arresting face, dominated by a huge, luscious-lipped mouth. She looked like a very pretty alien.
Pleased to meet you.
The nanny held out a limp hand. She had a strong French accent and looked bored out of her mind.
You too, said Jane. I always think it's nice for the nannies to get to know each other. Renata looked brightly between the two of them. A little support group, shall we say. What nationality are you?
She's not a nanny, Renata, said Madeline from the bench, her voice brimming with laughter.
Well, au pair then, said Renata impatiently.
Renata, listen to me. She's a mother, said Madeline. She's just young, you know, like we used to be.
Renata smiled uneasily at Jane, as if she suspected a practical joke. But before Jane had a chance to say anything, she felt like she should apologize. Someone said, "Here they come." And all the parents surged forward as a pretty, blonde, dimpled teacher who looked like she'd been cast for the role of kindergarten teacher ushered the children out from a classroom. Two little fair-haired boys charged out first, like they'd been shot from a gun, and headed straight for Celeste. "Ugh," grunted Celeste, as two little fair heads rammed her stomach.
I quite liked the idea of twins until Celeste had her little demons, Madeline had told Jane when they were having their champagne and orange juice, while Celeste smiled distractedly, apparently unoffended.
Chloe sauntered out of the classroom with her arms linked with two other little princess-like girls. Jane anxiously scanned the children for Ziggy. Had Chloe dumped him? There he was. He was one of the last to come out, but he looked happy. Jane gave him an okay, thumbs-up signal, and Ziggy lifted both thumbs up and grinned. There was a sudden commotion. Everyone stopped to look. It was a little curly-haired girl, the last one to come out of the classroom. She was sobbing, her shoulders hunched, clutching her neck.
"Oh," breathed the mothers, because she looked so pitiful and brave, and her hair was so pretty.
Jane watched Renata hurry over, followed at a more relaxed pace by her odd-looking nanny. The mother, the nanny, and the pretty blonde teacher all bent down to the little girl's height to listen to her.
"Mummy!"
Ziggy ran to Jane, and she scooped him up. It seemed like ages since she'd seen him, as if they'd both been on journeys to exotic far-off lands. She buried her nose in his hair. How was it? Was it fun? Before he could answer, the teacher called out. "Could all the parents and children listen up for a moment? We've had such a lovely morning, but we just need to have a little chat about something. It's a little bit serious." The teacher's dimples quivered in her cheeks, as if she were trying to put them away for a more appropriate time. Jane let Ziggy slide back down to his feet.
"What's going on?" said someone.
"Something happened to Amabella, I think," said another mother.
"Oh, God," said someone else quietly.
"Watch Renata get on the warpath."
"Now, someone just hurt Annabella. I'm sorry, Amabella, and I want whoever it was to come over and apologize, because we don't hurt our friends at school, do we?" said the teacher, in her teacher voice. "And if we do, we always say sorry, because that's what big kindergarten children do." There was silence. The children either stared blankly at the teacher or swayed back and forth, looking at their feet. Some of them buried their faces against their mother's skirts. One of Celeste's twin boys tugged on her shirt.
"I'm hungry."
Madeline hobbled over from her seat under the tree and stood next to Jane.
"What's the hold-up?"
She looked around her.
I don't even know where Chloe is.
Who was it, Amabella? Said Renata to the little girl. Who hurt you?
The little girl said something inaudible.
Was it an accident, maybe, Amabella? Said the teacher desperately.
It wasn't an accident, for heaven's sake, snapped Renata. Her face was aflame with righteous rage. Someone tried to choke her. I can see marks on her neck. I think she's going to have bruises.
Good Lord, said Madeline.
Jane watched the teacher squat down at the little girl's level, her arm around her shoulders, her mouth close to her ear.
Did you see what happened? Jane asked Ziggy.
He shook his head vigorously. The teacher stood back up and fiddled with her earring as she faced the parents.
Apparently one of the boys... My problem is that the children obviously don't know one another's names yet, so Amabella can't tell me exactly which little boy...
We're not going to let this go, interrupted Renata.
Absolutely not, agreed her hovering blonde friend.
Harper, thought Jane, trying to get all the names straight. Hovering Harper.
The teacher took a deep breath. No, we won't let it go. I wonder if I could ask all the children... maybe just the boys, to come over here for just a moment.
The parents pushed their sons forward with gentle shoves between the shoulder blades.
Over you go, said Jane to Ziggy.
He grabbed hold of her hand and looked up at her pleadingly.
I'm ready to go home now.
It's okay, said Jane. It's just for a moment. He wandered over and stood next to a boy who looked like a giant next to Ziggy. He was about a head taller than her son, with black curly hair and big strong shoulders. He looked like a little gangster. The boys formed a straggling line in front of the teacher. There were about 15, of all shapes and sizes. Celeste's fair-haired twins stood at the end. One of them was running a matchbox car over his brother's head, while the other one swatted it away like a fly.
It's like a police lineup, said Madeline.
Someone snickered. Stop it, Madeline.
They should all face forward, then turn to the side to show their profiles, continued Madeline.
To Celeste, she said, if it's one of your boys, Celeste, she won't be able to tell the difference. We'll have to do DNA testing.
Oh, wait. Do identical twins have the same DNA?
You can laugh, Madeline. Your child isn't a suspect, said another mother.
They've got the same DNA, but different fingerprints, said Celeste.
Right then, we'll have to dust for fingerprints, said Madeline.
Shh, said Jane, trying not to laugh.
She felt so desperately sorry for the mother of the child who was about to be publicly humiliated. The little girl called Amabella held onto her mother's hand. The red-headed nanny folded her arms and took a step back. Amabella surveyed the line of boys.
It was him, she said immediately. She pointed at the little gangster kid. He tried to choke me.
I knew it, thought Jane.
But then, for some reason, the teacher was putting her hand on Ziggy's shoulder, and the little girl was nodding, and Ziggy was shaking his head.
It wasn't me.
Yes, it was, said the little girl.
Detective Sergeant Adrian Quinlan.
A post-mortem is currently being undertaken to ascertain cause of death, but at this stage I can confirm the victim suffered right rib fractures, a shattered pelvis, fractured base of skull, right foot and lower vertebrae.
Chapter 7.
Oh, calamity, thought Madeline. Wonderful. She'd just made friends with the mother of a little thug. He'd seemed so cute and sweet in the car. Thank God he hadn't tried to choke Chloe. That would have been awkward. Also, Chloe would have knocked him out with a right hook.
Ziggy would never, said Jane. Her face had gone completely white. She looked horrified.
Madeline saw the other parents take tiny steps back, forming a circle of space around Jane.
It's all right. Madeline put a comforting hand on Jane's arm. They're children. They're not civilized yet.
Excuse me. Jane stepped past two other mothers and into the middle of the little crowd, like she was stepping onto a stage. She put her hand on Ziggy's shoulder. Madeline's heart broke for them both. Jane seemed young enough to be her own daughter. In fact, Jane reminded her a little of Abigail. That same prickliness and shy, dry humour.
Oh dear, fretted Celeste next to Madeline. This is awful.
I didn't do anything, said Ziggy in a clear voice.
Ziggy, we just need you to say sorry to Amabella, that's all, said Miss Barnes.
Beck Barnes had taught Fred when he was in kindergarten. It had been her first year out of teacher's college. She was good, but still very young, and a bit too anxious to please the parents, which was absolutely fine when the parent was Madeline, but not when Renata Klein was the parent, and out for revenge. Although, to be fair, any parent would want an apology if another child tried to choke theirs. It probably hadn't helped that Madeline had made Renata look silly for thinking Jane was the nanny. Renata didn't like to look silly. Her children were geniuses, after all. She had a reputation to uphold, board meetings to attend. Jane looked at Amabella.
Sweetheart, are you sure this was the boy who hurt you?
Could you say sorry to Amabella, please? You really hurt her quite badly, said Renata to Ziggy. She was speaking nicely, but firmly. Then we can all go home.
But it wasn't me, said Ziggy. He spoke very clearly and precisely, and looked Renata straight in the eye.
Madeline took her sunglasses off and chewed on the stem. Maybe it wasn't him. Could Amabella have gotten it wrong? But she was gifted. She was actually quite a lovely little girl too. She'd been on playdates with Chloe and was very easygoing and let Chloe boss her about, taking the supporting role in whatever game they were playing.
Don't lie, Renata snapped at Ziggy.
She dropped her well-bred, I'm still nice to other people's kids even when they hurt mine, demeanor. All you need to do is say sorry.
Madeline saw Jane's body react instantly, instinctively, like the sudden rear of a snake or pounce of an animal. Her back straightened, her chin lifted.
Ziggy doesn't lie.
Well, I can assure you Amabella is telling the truth.
The little audience became very still. Even the other children were quiet, except for Celeste's twins, who were chasing each other around the playground, yelling something about ninjas.
Okay, so we seem to have reached a stalemate here.
Miss Barnes clearly didn't know what in the world to do.
She was 24 years old, for heaven's sake. Chloe reappeared at Madeline's side, breathing hard from her exertions on the monkey bars.
I need a swim, she announced.
Shh, said Madeline.
Chloe sighed. May I have a swim, please, Mummy?
Just shh.
Madeline's ankle ached. This was not turning out to be a very good 40th birthday, thank you very much. So much for the festival of Madeline. She really needed to sit back down. Instead, she limped into the middle of the action.
Renata, she said, you know how children can be.
Renata swung her head to glare at Madeline.
The child needs to take responsibility for his actions. He needs to see there are consequences. He can't go around choking other children and pretend he didn't do it. Anyway, what's this got to do with you, Madeline? Mind your own beeswax.
Madeline bristled. She was only trying to help. And mind your own beeswax was such a profoundly geeky thing to say. Ever since the conflict over the theatre excursion for the gifted and talented children last year, she and Renata had been tetchy with each other, even though they were ostensibly still friends. Madeline actually liked Renata, but right from the beginning there had been something competitive about their relationship.
See, I'm just the sort of person who would be bored out of my mind if I had to be a full-time mother, Renata would say confidentially to Madeline, and that wasn't meant to be offensive because Madeline wasn't actually a full-time mother. She worked part-time. But still, there was always the implication that Renata was the smart one, the one who needed more mental stimulation because she had a career while Madeline had a job. It didn't help that Renata's older son, Jackson, was famous at school for winning chess tournaments, while Madeline's son, Fred, was famous for being the only student in the history of Piriwee Public brave enough to climb the giant Moreton Bay fig tree and then leap the impossible distance onto the roof of the music room to retrieve 34 tennis balls. The fire brigade had to be called to rescue him. Fred's street cred at school was sky high.
It doesn't matter, Mummy. Amabella looked up at her mother with eyes still teary. Madeline could see the red finger marks around the poor child's neck.
It does matter, said Renata. She turned to Jane. Please make your child apologize.
Renata, said Madeline. Stay out of it, Madeline.
Yes, I don't think we should get involved, Madeline, said Harper, who was predictably nearby and spent her life agreeing with Renata.
I'm sorry, but I just can't make him apologize for something he says he didn't do, said Jane.
Your child is lying, said Renata. Her eyes flashed behind her glasses.
I don't think he is, said Jane. She lifted her chin.
I just want to go home now. Please, Mummy, said Amabella.
She began to sob in earnest. Renata's weird-looking new French nanny, who had been silent the whole time, picked her up, and Amabella wrapped her legs around her waist and buried her face in her neck. A vein pulsed in Renata's forehead. Her hands clenched and unclenched.
This is completely unacceptable, she said to poor, distraught Miss Barnes, who was probably wondering why they hadn't covered situations like this at Teachers College.
Renata leaned down so that her face was only inches away from Ziggy.
If you ever touch my little girl like that again, you will be in big trouble.
Hey, said Jane.
Renata ignored her. She straightened and spoke to the nanny.
Let's go, Juliet.
They marched off through the playground while all the parents pretended to be busy tending to their children. Ziggy watched them go, He looked up at his mother, scratched the side of his nose, and said, I don't think I want to come to school anymore. Samantha. All the parents have to go down to the police station and make a statement. I haven't had my turn yet. I feel quite sick about it. They'll probably think I'm guilty. Seriously, I feel guilty when a police car pulls up next to me at the traffic lights. Chapter 8. 5 months before the trivia night.
The reindeers ate the carrots.
Madeline opened her eyes in the early morning light to see a half-eaten carrot shoved in front of her eyes by Chloe. Ed, who was snoring gently next to her, had taken a lot of time and care last night gnawing on the carrots to make the most authentic-looking reindeer bites. Chloe was sitting comfortably astride Madeline's stomach in her pajamas, hair like a mop, big grin, wide awake, shiny eyes. Madeline rubbed her own eyes and looked at the clock. 6 a.m. Probably the best they could hope for.
Do you think Santa Claus left Fred a potato?
Said Chloe hopefully.
Because he's been pretty naughty this year.
Madeline had told her children that if they were naughty, Santa Claus might leave them a wrapped-up potato, and they would always wonder what the wonderful gift was that the potato replaced. It was Chloe's dearest wish for Christmas that her brother would receive a potato. It would probably please her more than the dollhouse under the tree. Madeline has seriously considered wrapping up potatoes for both of them. It would be such an incentive for good behaviour throughout the next year.
Remember the potato, she could say.
But Ed wouldn't let her. He was too damned nice.
Is your brother up yet? She said to Chloe. I'll wake him, shouted Chloe.
And before Madeline could stop her, she was gone, pounding down the hallway. Ed stirred. It's not morning time, is it? It couldn't be morning time.
Deck the halls with something and holly, sang Madeline. Tra-la-la-la-la, la-la-la-la.
I'll pay you $1,000 if you stop that sound right now, said Ed. He put his pillow over his face. For a very nice man, he was surprisingly cruel about her singing.
You don't have $1,000, said Madeline, and she launched into silent night.
Her mobile phone beeped with a text message, and Madeline picked it up from the bedside table while still singing. It was Abigail. It was Abigail's year to spend Christmas Eve and morning with her father, Bonnie, and her half-sister. Skye, who was born 3 months after Chloe, was a fair-haired, fey little girl who followed Abigail around like an adoring puppy. She also looked a lot like Abigail had when she was a child, which made Madeline feel uneasy and sometimes teary, as though something precious had been stolen from her. It was clear that Abigail preferred Skye to Chloe and Fred, who refused to idolize her. And Madeline often found herself thinking, But Abigail, Chloe and Fred are your real brother and sister. You should love them more. Which was not technically true. Madeline could not quite believe that all three had equal footing as Abigail's half-siblings. She read the text. Merry Christmas, Mum. Dad, Bonnie, Skye and me, all here at the shelter. From 5:30 a.m. I've already peeled 40 potatoes. It's a beautiful experience being able to contribute like this. Feel so blessed. Love, Abigail.
She's never peeled a freaking potato in her life, muttered Madeline as she texted back. That's wonderful, darling. Merry Xmas to you too. See you soon. Kiss, kiss, kiss.
She put the phone down on the bedside table with a bang, suddenly exhausted, and tried her best to restrain the little eruption of fury behind her eyes. Feel so blessed. A beautiful experience. This from a 14-year-old who whined if she was asked to set the table. Her daughter was starting to sound just like Bonnie.
Bleh,
she said out loud. Bonnie had arranged for the whole family to volunteer at a homeless shelter on Christmas morning. I just hate all that crass commercialism of Christmas, don't you? She'd told Madeline last week when they'd run into each other in the shops. Madeline had been doing Christmas shopping, and her wrists were looped with dozens of plastic shopping bags. Fred and Chloe were both eating lollipops, their lips a garish red. Meanwhile, Bonnie was carrying a tiny bonsai tree in a pot, and Skye was walking along next to her, eating a pear. A fucking pear, Madeline had told Celeste later. For some reason, she couldn't get over the pear. How in the world had Bonnie managed to get Madeline's ex-husband out of bed at that time of morning to go to work in a homeless shelter? Nathan wouldn't get up before 8 a.m. in the 10 years they'd been together. Bonnie must give him organic blowjobs. Abigail is having a beautiful experience with Bonnie at the homeless shelter, Madeline said to Ed. Ed took his pillow off his face.
That's revolting, he said.
I know, said Madeline. This is why she loved him.
Coffee, he said sympathetically. I'll get you coffee.
Presents! Shouted Chloe and Fred from down the hallway.
Chloe and Fred couldn't get enough of the crass commercialism of Christmas. Harper. Can you imagine how strange it must have been for Madeline to have her ex-husband's child in the same kindergarten class as her own child?
I remember Renata and I talked about it over brunch. We were quite concerned how it would affect the classroom dynamics. Of course, Bonnie loved to pretend it was all so nice and amicable. Oh, we all have Christmas lunch together. Spare me. I saw them at the trivia night. I saw Bonnie throw her drink all over Madeline.
Chapter 9. It was just becoming light when Celeste woke up on Christmas morning. Perry was snoring gently, and there was no sound from the adjoining room where the boys were sleeping. They'd been almost demented with excitement about Santa Claus finding them in Canada. Letters had been sent to Santa informing him of the change of address, and with their body clocks all confused, she and Perry had had terrible trouble getting them off to sleep. The boys were sharing a king-sized bed, and they kept wrestling in that hysterical way they sometimes did, where laughter skidded into tears and then back again into laughter, and Perry had shouted from the next room, "Go to sleep, boys!" And all of a sudden there was silence. And when Celeste had checked in a few seconds later, they were both lying flat on their backs, arms and legs spread, as if exhaustion had simultaneously knocked them out cold. "Come and look at this," she'd said to Perry, and he'd come in and stood next to her, and they'd watched them sleep for a few minutes before grinning at each other and tiptoeing out to have a drink to celebrate Christmas Eve. Now Celeste slid out from underneath the feathery quilt and walked to the window overlooking the frozen lake. She put her hand flat against the glass. It felt cold, but the room was warm. There was a giant Christmas tree in the center of the lake, glowing with red and green lights. Snowflakes fell softly. It was all so beautiful, she felt like she could taste it. When she looked back on this holiday, she'd remember its flavor, full and fruity, like the mulled wine they'd had earlier.
Today, after the boys had opened their presents and they'd eaten a room service breakfast, pancakes with maple syrup, they'd go out to play in the snow. They'd build a snowman. Perry had booked them on a sleigh ride. Perry would post pictures of them all frolicking.